Europeans fat and made them well-fed and made them educated and gave them the luxury and time to go to universities and build universities and things like that, but they've come at our expense. We are going to have to organize. We're going to have to organize here in North America. How long do we run from Africa trying to get to North America, trying to get to Europe to enjoy the resources that are right there in Africa that's been stolen by Europeans? This system has to be brought down, this whole system, this whole relationship of resource transference from Africa to Europe and to North America and to increasingly to China and other places. And so we find ourselves envying those people who are living off the flesh of our Africa and our people. We have to build a revolution. We have to build revolutionaries. We have to move beyond this NGOism and things like that. So, Comrade Luwezi, I want to thank you for being with us today on Africa Live. I am Omali Ishitela. It has been an incredibly important discussion that we've had with Luwezi Kinshasa, who is the Secretary General of the African Socialist International. And he and I are both, along with the Uhuru Radio, the Uhuru movement, involved in the struggle to liberate and unify Africa and African people worldwide. Uhuru.
Africa Live.
Uhuru, you're listening to Reparations in Action on uhururadio.com, the online voice of the International African Revolution. Reparations in Action is the official program of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, the organization of white people and other allies working under the leadership of the African Revolution.
Dad's not here today. You see, the police, they came and they took him for a ride. You see, he would not fight in that war, you know, the one they call the war against the poor. And he would not bow down to genocide. We
Indian was always the bad guy. It's 96 and I'ma keep on rapping and make sure nobody forgets that it happened. The government still ain't scaring me. It's Lightfoot, fool, and I'm proud to be a Cherokee. As I look up, disgust only hovers me. Plus Chris Columbus gets credit for discovery, and now they wanna be a friend again. Damn, you better run from this Indian.
Uhuru. That was My Land by Lightfoot from the album A Good Day to Die. You are listening to Reparations in Action on uhururadio.com, the online voice of the International African Revolution. Reparations in Action is the official program of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, the organization of white people and other allies working under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party. We express our appreciation to the African People's Socialist Party and to Uhuru Radio for giving us this hour every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for our program, Reparations in Action. My name is Jesse Neville. I am the National Outreach Chair of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement and a member of the African People's Solidarity Committee. I am joined today by Johan Bedingfield, the Information and Education Chair of USM, as well as a member of APSC. Uhuru, Johan. And we are excited to also be joined today by Inamiki Tupac Kashena, an indigenous comrade and a member of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. Uhuru, comrade.
Uhuru.
Uhuru. So the theme of today's show is This Land Is Not Our Land, Solidarity with Indigenous Resistance.
And we choose to focus on this topic tonight as the recent celebration of the holiday known as Thanksgiving. Today we will be discussing the two origins of Thanksgiving, the genocide against the indigenous people and the theft of the land, and the historic and ongoing legacy of heroic indigenous resistance to colonial occupation.
We titled today's program, This Land Is Not Our Land, because we recognize that this country was founded on the European genocide against the indigenous people and the theft of their land, as well as the enslavement of millions of African people. And we recognize that as white people, we are a colonial settler population living at the expense of the indigenous people who are facing conditions of colonial poverty and oppression on concentration camps, euphemistically referred to as reservations, where the average life expectancy is 42 years old. It is this legacy of colonial domination and genocide that is celebrated in the holiday known as Thanksgiving that just took place on Thursday. Growing up in this country, we are fed a completely mythological version of the origins of Thanksgiving. We are shown images of pilgrims and Indians seated happily at the dinner table together. We reject this false mythology. We recently posted on the Uhuru Solidarity Movement's blog an excerpt from a piece by Glenn Ford, the editor of the Black Agenda Report and the vice chair of the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations. In his piece entitled The American Thanksgiving, Rejoicing in Genocide and White Supremacy, Glenn Ford writes, quote, Thanksgiving did not begin as a great loving relationship between the pilgrims and the Wampanoag, Pequot, and Narragansett people. In fact, in October of 1621, when the pilgrim survivors of their first winter in Turtle Island sat down to share the first unofficial Thanksgiving meal, the Indians who were there were not even invited. There was no turkey, squash, cranberry sauce, or pumpkin pie. A few days before this alleged feast took place, a company of pilgrims, led by Miles Standish, actively sought the head of a local Indian chief, and an 11-foot-high wall was erected around the entire Plymouth settlement for the very purpose of keeping Indians out. It is much more likely that Chief Massasoit either crashed the party or brought enough men to ensure that he was not kidnapped or harmed by the pilgrims. Dr. Pinga Apidba writes in the book Black Folks' Guide to Understanding Thanksgiving, that the settlers brandished their weaponry early and got drunk soon thereafter. He notes that each pilgrim drank at least a half a gallon of beer a day, which they preferred even to water. This daily inebriation led their governor, William Bradford, to comment on his people's, quote, notorious sin, which included their drunkenness, uncleanliness, and, quote, rampant sodomy. Soon after the feast, the brutish Miles Standish got his bloody prize, Dr. Apidpa writes. He went to the Indians, pretended to be a traitor, then beheaded an Indian man named Wutuwamut. He brought the head to Plymouth, where it was displayed on a wooden spike for many years, as a symbol of white power. Standish had the Indian man's young brother hanged from the rafters for good measure. From that time on, the whites were known to the Indians of Massachusetts by the name Wotokunange, which in their tongue meant cutthroats and stabbers. What is certain is that the first feast was not called Thanksgiving. No further integrated dining occasions were scheduled, and the first official all-pilgrim Thanksgiving had to wait until 1637, when the whites of New England celebrated the massacre of the Wampanoag's southern neighbors, the Pequots. 16 years after the problematical Plymouth feast, the English tried mightily to erase the Pequots from the face of the earth, and thanked God for the blessing. Having subdued, intimidated, or made mercenaries of most of the tribes of Massachusetts, the English turned their growing force southward, toward the rich Connecticut Valley, the Pequot's sphere of influence. At the point where the Mystic River meets the sea, the combined force of English and allied Indians bypassed the Pequot fort to attack and set ablaze a town full of women, children, and old people. Many prisoners were executed. Surviving women and children were sold into slavery in the West Indies. William Bradford, the former governor of Plymouth and one of the chroniclers of the 1621 feast, was also on hand for the great massacre of 1637. He wrote, "Those that escaped the fire were slain with the sword, some hewed to pieces, others run through with their rapiers, so that they were quickly dispatched, and very few escaped. It was conceived they thus destroyed about 400 at this time. It was a fearful sight to see them thus frying in the fire. Horrible was the stink and scent thereof, but the victory seemed a sweet sacrifice, and they gave the prayers thereof to God, who had wrought so wonderfully for them, thus to enclose their enemies in their hands and give them so speedy a victory over so proud and insulting an enemy," end quote. The rest of the white folks thought so too. Quote, "This day forth shall be a day of celebration and thanksgiving for subduing the Pequots," read Governor John Winthrop's proclamation. The authentic Thanksgiving Day was born. And now I want to once again give a really warm welcome to our guest today, Inamiki Tupac Keshena, who is the editor of a political blog website called The Speed of Dreams, which you can see at bermudaradical.wordpress.com. He is also a member of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. Uhuru comrade,
Uhuru,
could you please tell our listeners more about yourself, where you are from, and how you came into contact with the Uhuru movement?
Yeah, sure, comrade Jesse. Just one quick thing first. I'll give you a hand with the pronunciation of my name. It's Inamiki Tupac Keshena, not Keshena.
Don't
worry, that catches a lot of people, so no biggie. I'm a member of the Menominee Nation, which is currently located in Wisconsin. One of the few tribes in that state that is actually from that state. Most of the other tribes there were relocated there through the colonial government's efforts to push Indians west. However, I grew up in Bermuda. My mother is an Indian from Milwaukee and grew up in that city, though most of our family and her family lives on the reservation north of Green Bay. She met my father, who's a Bermudian, and promptly moved to Bermuda where I grew up. But growing up in Bermuda was a major politicizing experience in my life, because when I was born, Bermuda was still under a form of like official white minority rule. For 30 years, a party had governed Bermuda called the United Bermuda Party, which was essentially the party of the white settlers and aspects of the African petty bourgeoisie. And they didn't finally lose their hold on government until I was 12 years old. And I'll always distinctly remember this image in my mind of the school I went to, which was about 60% African and about 40% white, and then my brother and myself, that all the white kids got really scared. I guess their parents had told them that with the quote-unquote black government coming to power, that the white people were all going to lose all their homes and all their businesses. And in fact, there was a significant amount of white flight, primarily to Australia and New Zealand. And so that was a major politicizing experience, being a young child and seeing these white kids absolutely terrified at the idea that the white party had lost power, and seeing my African friends simultaneously celebrating. A lot of them actually took the day off school to celebrate with their families the fall of the United Bermuda Party from government. At the same time, though, whenever summer breaks rolled around, my brother and I were promptly sent off to our family in Wisconsin to spend the summer with our grandmother, who lived in a small town called Shawano, just off the Menominee Reservation. And that was likewise also a very politicizing experience. You picture Shawano is a small town of about 7,000, maybe it's about 10,000 people now, it's been some time since I was there, of white people in the far north of Wisconsin, and they all fly Confederate flags. So they don't even attempt to hide their sympathies. Those people there, if you even look like you're from the reservation, they won't serve you, they won't sell you a drink if you go into the gas station. And it was always incredibly nervous to be around there, to see all these white people who just... Because I hadn't experienced that in Bermuda, because the white people there, because they didn't really have experience with Indians, didn't really know what to do with me. But also to go onto the reservation up there and see the just abject level of poverty that my family there lived in. I can remember, I have very vivid memories of as a child of just seeing family members living in run-down trailer homes and just widespread poverty, alcoholism. A lot of my family members have had to battle alcoholism, drug addiction. And so, yeah, so that really kind of set the stage for my politics and how I kind of got into that. My mother helped push me as well. Her and members of my family were always really involved in the indigenous resistance movement or facets of it. And when I went to university in North America, that's when I first encountered indigenous resistance movements directly. And I began to involve myself in them. At the time, I also came under the influence of Marxist politics and internalized them in a lot of the Eurocentric problems with them that, of course, the Uhuru movement correctly points out all the time as problems with Marxism and their analysis. But when I came to encounter the Uhuru movement, I'm sure as a lot of comrades do, initially through the music of Dead Prez. I always remember the first time I put in their first album, Let's Get Free, and hearing Chairman O'Malley speak on the first track. And I latched onto that immediately. But I didn't immediately take up those politics. Later on, I came to read texts, though, like Jay Sakai's Settlers, The Mythology of the White Proletariat. And when I read Settlers, which is really a boogeyman for much of the white left in North America, because he comes right out and says settlers are not proletarian, etc., that I said, hey, this sounds a lot with like what I heard from the Uhuru movement. So I went back and I investigated the Uhuru movement, and I bought texts like O'Malley Yeshitela Speaks, One Africa, One Nation, and began to read them and began to immediately see just the correctness of the analysis of African internationalism. And it was also through dialoguing with the Uhuru movement, becoming a member of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, that I encountered Union del Barrio and their politics on indigenous liberation, while they do come out of the Chicano movement, has been incredibly influential on my views as well.
Uhuru. Thank you, Comrade Inamake Tupac Kashina. We want to remind our listeners that you can actually call in or email in and participate in this discussion if you have questions or comments. The call-in information for listeners in the U.S. is 727-565-1599. For listeners in the UK, the number is 020-8133-6629. If you want to call in through Skype, our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio. And if you want to email your questions or comments on the show today, the email address is dj@uhururadio.com. So in light of the recent Thanksgiving holiday, we have devoted today's program to a discussion on the European colonial genocide that decimated the majority of the indigenous population of this hemisphere. Comrade Inamake, could you tell our listeners more about what the so-called Americas were like prior to the European invasion?
Yeah, sure, Jesse. Well, firstly, before the European assault on the Americas, which I tend to refer to as Turtle Island, as that's a very common indigenous term for the continent. So before the European assault on Turtle Island, in what Western scholars always call our prehistories, if history didn't exist before white people, this continent was incredibly densely populated by a diverse array of peoples and cultures. Indigenous people inhabited every region of the continent, living within all of the ecological regions and developing cultures dependent on the land. There was also an incredible amount of commonality of cultures within these regions because of a natural relationship between culture and people's mode of existence. I'll give you just a brief picture of what so-called pre-Columbian or prehistory life was like in the Americas. In the coastal region of the Pacific Northwest, which ran from Alaska through British Columbia down as far as Northern Carolina, and which was perhaps the most densely populated region of the continent in terms of the number of nations and cultures present, lived peoples like the Tlingit, the Haida, the Tsimshian, the Klok-Klok, Kalak, the Nootsanoos, the Nuhulk, the Salish, and the Yurok, and many others. And these peoples developed cultures largely around fishing, especially salmon fishing. Contrary to popular belief, especially the beliefs of a lot of white environmentalists, these peoples generally did not engage in whaling. And one of their more important cultural practices was something called the potlatch, which was a ceremony where guests were honored by the host with generous gifts, the purpose of which was varied from the redistribution of wealth, the maintenance conference and recognition of social status, cementing alliances, celebration of marriage, and the commemoration of important events. The potlatch, along with the sun dance developed by the Plains peoples, was one of the most notable practices of Indian peoples to be outright banned by the colonial governments in the United States and Canada. Heading east, we get to the Plains, and it was in the Plains, which is a vast region stretching from Texas up to southern Alberta and Saskatchewan and Manitoba, and eastward to the Dakotas, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Missouri, Arkansas, lived a number of very well-known indigenous nations: the Lakota, the Cheyenne, the Arapaho, the Plains Cree, the Blackfoot Confederacy, the Shoshone, the Mandan, and their way of life was based on the hunt, principally the hunt of the buffalo. And while there was as much as a million people living in the plains, there was as much as 80 million buffalo who were subsequently slaughtered en masse by Europeans as part of their campaign to win the West, which involved starving the Indians out of their traditional subsistence base. Further east, in the woodland area from the Great Lakes to the Atlantic coast, another group of well-known nations, most notably the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, sometimes called the Iroquois Confederacy, which included the Cayuga, the Mohawk, Oneida, Onondaga, Seneca, and Tuscarora, as well as the number of Anishinaabe peoples like the Algonquin and the Nipissing, and my own people, the Menominee. They were based on hunting and fishing as well, but they also developed farming. When white people came there, see, because white people think that a lot of Indians were just primitive hunters and gatherers, but when European explorers first reached this area, there are incredible descriptions of orchards, you know, fields of corn, fields of beans that were fenced in and like anything you would expect to see in Europe. You know, so people did actually develop complex agricultural societies, you know, And this extends further south, the eastern seaboard, through the Virginias, down to Florida and the Gulf of Mexico region with Mississippi and Louisiana. And the Muscogee-speaking people, like the Choctaw, the Creek, and the Seminole, and also the Natchez and the Cherokee, who themselves were cultural and linguistic cousins of the Iroquois. This region was one of the most fertile agricultural belts, not only in Turtle Island, but in the entire world. And here, the practice of farming was well established, and hunting and fishing only served to supplement it. They weren't primary mode of subsistence. And then down in the Southwest, the cultures of the Southwest also extend down into Mexico, all the way down to the Mexica, the people otherwise known as the Aztec. And there, again, a diverse array of peoples, varying from agrarian peoples to nomadic, like the Zuni, the human-speaking peoples like the Hualapai and the Mojave and the Cocopa, and Utoho Aztecan-speaking people like the Hopi and the Pimas, and also Athapascan people like the Navajo and the Apache, who had in fact actually migrated to the Southwest from the interior of British Columbia and Alaska. But despite all this diversity of ecological regions and modes of subsistence, with a few notable exceptions, the societies of indigenous peoples were largely classless and communitarian, and they often sported strong matrilineal features. In the sphere of politics, men weren't dominant, and in many cultures, especially cultures like the Iroquois, politics and power in society was the responsibility of women. Additionally, elders also universally held positions of importance and honor for their knowledge. There were no prisons because Indian societies had developed methods of resolving community problems, and we know this from accounts of elders, there was very little in the way of antisocial crime. Community decisions were also made frequently by consensus and discussions amongst the people.
That's really incredible. Now, hearing about the civilizations of indigenous people on this earth is as human or minus the terror of African people and sources has taught about. How terrorism did not as monsters was to play a historically progressive role. Terrorism represented progress only for a tiny percent of the more population. If you look at the world from the point of view of African indigenous people, terrorism actually set back civilization. It was born through the European destruction of African indigenous civilizations.
Ooh, yes, definitely. And also, what is often left out of the historical narrative presented in U.S. classrooms, you know, in addition to the whole, you know, just the breadth of information that, you know, Comrade Inamike has been telling us about these indigenous societies that once existed, you know, the other thing we don't hear about in U.S. classrooms is that the indigenous people resisted colonization every step of the way, such as in the so-called Indian Wars in the West and Southwest. Comrade Inamike, could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, sure, of course. The Indian Wars refers to the fact that while the United States was beginning the process of establishing itself as an imperialist world power following the so-called American Revolution, it was also still struggling to consolidate its own continental land base. This process, of course, required the mass removals of indigenous peoples, either through outright extermination as well as other means. Of course, as you just said, Jesse, Indian peoples were not willing to just go quietly and without a fight, and so the colonists faced armed resistance at every turn. The Indian Wars can, in fact, be traced back to that period immediately just after the American Revolution, and in those early years when they first formed the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which you have to remember is a government agency that still exists, the Bureau of Indian Affairs was first organized as a part of the War Department. American settlers waged war against Indian peoples across the entire frontier settlement, from the Shawnee to the Mississippi Valley to the Seminole in Florida. Starting in 1830, they implemented the Indian Removal Act, which saw settler law begin to codify the removal of Indians from their land. This act was then followed up in 1834 with the reorganization of the various colonial state departments dealing with Indian repression. Also, they introduced the so-called Indian Trade and Intercourse Act, which redefined what was previously so-called Indian territory and the so-called permanent Indian frontier. Before the Indian Trade and Intercourse Act, the permanent Indian frontier had been defined as lands west of the Mississippi River, but this act redefined it. And this act came into existence following the formation of the territory, the U.S. territories of Wisconsin and Iowa. It redrew the line of the so-called permanent Indian frontier to the 95th meridian. So combined with the Indian Removal Act, this allowed settler... Combined with the Indian Removal Act, this within settler law, this allowed for colonial troops to actually force thousands of people, like the Cherokee, into concentration camps in Oklahoma, which for them followed a devastating forced westward march called the Trail of Tears. And it was during this time, the Trail of Tears, that one in four Cherokees died from cold, hunger, and diseases. Many other nations were also forcibly evicted through their land, from their land through a combination of colonial law and military force, including the Choctaw, the Chickasaws, the Creeks, Shawnees, Miamis, Odawas, Wendans, and Delawares. The permanent Indian frontier itself also became a militarized line of U.S. garrisons. However, of course, as I've said, it was the so-called Indian permanent Indian frontier because, as history has shown us, the settlers never had any intention of the Indian frontier being anything like permanent. With the U.S. occupation and annexation of northern Mexico following the Mexican-American War, the U.S. acquired vast territories in the southwest. And in the same year, 1848, as the end of the Mexican-American War, gold was discovered in California. And with this came a large-scale invasion of the remainder of the unoccupied Turtle Island. This begins the period that some people refer to as like the Indian Wars proper. And under the ideological justification of manifest destiny, the U.S. launched this second period of wars of extermination and removal against the diverse peoples of those areas. War raged from the Great Lakes to the Rio Grande and west of the Pacific coast. The wars were against the Lakota, the Cheyenne, Comanche, Kiowa, Yakima, Nez Perce, Walla Walla, Cayuse, Arapaho, Apache, and many, many other peoples. However, as I said, Indian people just didn't take this line down. They didn't go quietly into the night. And this period saw the rise of some of the greatest people ever to lead our nations, including Crazy Horse, Sitting Bull, Ten Pears, Victorio, Geronimo, Connor Parker, Revoca, Black Kettle, Red Cloud, and Chief Joseph. And these leaders and the people fighting under them who resisted colonization and extermination also gave the colonists some of their greatest defeats. Just for one illustration is in 1878, in the Northern Plains, an alliance developed between the Lakota, the Northern Cheyenne, and the Arapaho. And this alliance defeated the United States at the Battle of the Greasy Grass, which is known in the more heroic fantasy literature of America as Custer's Last Stand. It's also sometimes called the Battle of the Little Bighorn. And this battle began as an attempted massacre of what was thought to be a primarily civilian Indian encampment by the American 7th Cavalry, which was commanded by that cowardly butcher, George Armstrong Custer. While Custer had expected to primarily encounter and slaughter women and children with a force of only 800 what they called non-reservation hostiles to defend them, in actuality, his own Crow Indian scouts had warned him that it was the largest Indian encampment they'd ever seen. He, of course, didn't listen, and when he went out to kill some Indian women and children in the name of America, white power, and personal glory, he wasn't deterred by their warnings. And when he attacked, he was met by this combined Lakota, Northern Cheyenne, Arapaho force of thousands under the command of Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse. The battle raged on for hours, and as the warriors from those nations slowly closed in, Custer even ordered his own men to shoot their own horses and stack their carcasses to form a wall, but it provided little protection against the bullets of the warriors, and by the end of the day, Custer and his personal attachment of men had all died.
Uhuru. Uhuru. Well, thank you so much, comrade. I think the first half of our program today has been an incredible history of the colonization of the indigenous people and the historical resistance of the indigenous people to colonial occupation, and we're going to have a short break now. When we return, we were going to be talking about more recent examples of the indigenous people's resistance, as well as how we as Europeans, North Americans, white people can stand in solidarity with the liberation of indigenous people, African people, and all colonized and oppressed peoples. So we will be back shortly. Uhuru.
Get on board, get on board the Carnival cruise ship Valor for the third annual Marcus Garvey Legacy Tour to Cozumel, Mexico, Ocho Rios, Jamaica, and the Grand Cayman.
It's just going to be a fantastic cruise. I'm really excited.
Ship sails on Sunday, December 2nd, leaving from Miami, Florida, and returning on December 9th. Featured guest on this historical tour will be the leader of the African Socialist International, Chairman O'Malley Ishatella.
Our effort is to do what Garvey did, to build a single organization with a single center, Africans organized throughout the world who are revolutionaries to liberate and unite Africa and African people.
And yours truly, Ron Bob Semple, will transform you with my one-man cultural and educational presentation, The Spirit of Marcus Garvey.
Mr. Dancy was used by this government to testify against me. You heard him when the prosecutor asked him whether any of the letters were from the Black Star Line.
He couldn't remember.
He couldn't remember. Mr. Dancy can't read. My life is at stake and he couldn't remember.
In Jamaica, we'll spend time with members of the Garvey family who still reside at his birth home in St. Anne. There is still plenty of room aboard the Carnival cruise ship Valor for the third annual Marcus Garvey Legacy Cruise. For more detailed information, call Tanya at 352-693-3034. That's 352-693-3034 today. Or sign up now by visiting uhurulegacycruise.org. On aboard! On aboard!
Yo, San Diego!
Marcus Callender.
When we say self-determination, we're talking about black power. We're talking about power over our own lives and in our own hands. And that's what real freedom means.
November 27th at the World Peace Center.
7 to 9 p.m.
The same money that's going to police and whatnot need to be in the possession of the African community so that we have not only schools, but schools that function under the control of the African community, because the struggle that we're involved in is one for power in our own hands.
President of the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement, NPDEM.
NPDEM.
Diop Olubala.
But we also know that resistance in isolation and as an individual, that's not going to cut it. We know that the only real way that we're going to win power in our own hands is through building real organizational capacity.
No more standing on the sidelines. It's time to get in the game.
What are you going to do about
the lack of economic development in our community?
The miseducation of our school children.
Did you know that
every 36 hours an African is killed by the police in the U.S.?
Your iPhone, iPad, laptop, airplane, all of it is a direct result of theft, murder, and slavery in Africa today.
Come join Diop as he puts forth a strategic plan to deal with our objective reality. November 27th at the World Peace Center.
7 to 9 p.m.
For more info, 619-500-4298 or visit npedumresistance.wordpress.com. The Uhuru Movement.
Not just explaining the world, but changing the world.
But we understand more than anything that the resistance has got to be organized.
Uhuru. Welcome back to Reparations in Action here on uhururadio.com, the online voice of the International African Revolution. My name is Jesse Neville, and I'm here today with Johan Bedingfield, as well as Comrade Enamike Tupac Kashina. And we've also been joined by the chairwoman of the African People's Solidarity Committee, Penny Hess. Uhuru, Chairwoman Penny.
Uhuru, Jesse, Johan, and Uhuru, Comrade Enamike. It's really excellent having you on the show, and just has been a great presentation and history that you've given us prior, you know, just earlier. So I really appreciate the show and welcome you. Uhuru.
Uhuru.
Uhuru. So, Comrade Inamake, you lived for many years in the colonial settler state of Canada, where there have been and still are today powerful instances of Indigenous resistance. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, of course, Comrade Jesse. So, while there were instances that sprung up in places like Chapaten, Ipawash, Caledonia, Grassy Narrows, and other places since the 1990s, for our listeners, I would like to focus in on what I think is perhaps the most well-known act of defiance against colonialism in Canada, and it in many ways is the act that inspired the rest of them, and that is the resistance of the Mohawk people at Oka. I focus on Oka not only because it is the spark that set fire to the prairie, paraphrasing Chairman Mao, but also because it's a powerful example of how Indians have challenged the borders that have been imposed on us by the colonists. A border which runs right through the traditional territory of the Six Nations, which includes the Mohawk, as well as also the Anishinaabe peoples, various Plains peoples, etc. So, to tell you about Oka, to begin with, picture this. Outside a small town just west of Montreal, by the cool brown river waters of the Ottawa River, a community of Indians has erected a simple soil work barricade across the dirt road heading towards a pine grove and cemetery. And there stood a community assembled of men, women, elders, and children of the Mohawk Nation at a town, a settlement called Ganasatage, near the white town of Oka. And they stood in defense of land that they held sacred. What the white press would later come to call the quote-unquote Oka crisis began on July 11, 1990 and lasted until September 26, 1990. And over the course of this period, three people died, and the event served as a flashpoint for a series of conflicts and confrontations between the colonial settler government of Canada and the native peoples, which is to this day yet to see resolution. The rebellion in Oka exploded principally out of the pursuit by the Gunyakahaga, or Mohawk, of a land claim, which included a burial ground and a sacred grove of pine trees near their village of Ganasatage. This brought them into direct conflict with the settler town of Oka, which sought to develop a private, exclusive, members-only golf course and an upscale residential area on this sacred land. To the people of Ganasatage, this land was the remnant of a shrieking legacy, their root, their place in the world, the place where their ancestors dwelt. It was their home. To the people of Oka, to the white people, Francophone, French-speaking people of Oka, it was just a potential golf course and condo development. So enraged by the failure of the land claims process in Canada and the history of deceit from the settler community and the decision of the courts just before this, to basically uphold the settlers' plan, the people of Ganasatage were given no other choice but to take action directly into their hands. And in order to resist the decision by the courts to go ahead with the final destruction of their sacred land, members of the community erected this simple barricade made of soil across a simple dirt road, blocking access to the areas in question. Oka Mayor Jean Boulet, a white Francophone person, demanded compliance with the court order. The Mohawk people refused. Livid that these Indians would dare disobey the orders of the colonial state and engage in peaceful protest, Mayor Ouellette, on July 11th, requested the presence of the Sûreté de Québec, the SQ. It's like the Quebec Provincial Police. Suspicious as to what the SQ may try to do to dislodge them from their barricades, the warriors of the Mohawk Nation, because the Mohawk have always maintained a warrior society, along with allies from other nations, in accordance with the ancient constitution of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, asked the women whether or not they should use an arsenal of small arms, AK-47 shotguns, rifles that they had amassed. The decision of the women was that the warriors were to operate under a strict no-shoot-first policy. They were only to use arms if the SQ opened first. So it was not long after this decision that it was put to the test, as a community spiritual leader was burning tobacco at the site. The SQ arrived at the barricades as a heavily armed SWAT team, and they swiftly deployed to attack the protesters. Responding to this invasion, immediately the women charged to the front with the knowledge that under their traditions, it was their obligation to protect their land, the Earth Mother. Soon, a state of confusion developed, and the SQ actually began to retreat. As they retreated, they launched tear gas and concussion devices at the Mohawk people. This would not rattle the warriors and the women, though. In fact, it only made their resolve stronger, and they dug into their positions. As if by like the there was divine intervention, the wind actually blew the tear gas of the SQ back at them, and also onto a major highway called Highway 344. Now in a state of full retreat, the SQ were forced to leave behind their equipment, including six police cruisers and a payloader. The warriors and the community then quickly expropriated these and used a payloader to overturn the cruisers and push them into an even larger blockade, this time blocking the actual main highway artery. In these days after the initial engagement, news coverage of it actually exploded, not only in the Canadian media, but also in the American and international media as well. Protests and acts of solidarity erupted all across occupied Turtle Island on both sides of the artificial settler border. The Gunyakahaga were joined by Indians from all over North America, even traditional leaders from as far south as Mexico, and of course members of their own brother and sister nations in the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Some came to show spiritual and political support as a nearby peace camp was established, while others came as warriors and took their places behind the barricades. The Mohawk themselves were forged This event forged them into a broad, united front against this colonial destruction of the sacred lands, despite disagreements between various factions within their own community. Additionally, to the east of Oka, at Montreal, Montreal is an island, if you don't really know, and one of the major arteries for it is something called the Mercier Bridge, and the Mercier Bridge passes right through another Mohawk community called Ganawage. And in Ganawage, the warriors formed a blockade of this major artery into Montreal in a courageous act of solidarity with their Mohawk brothers and sisters to the west. At the peak of the crisis, the warriors refused to dismantle their barricades, and the SQ established their own to restrict access to Oka from about 5 kilometers outside of it, and brought in more than 1,000 police officers to Oka. Itself was a town of only 1,800 people. With all the blockades erected, travel on the Mercier Bridge and highway routes 132, 138, 207 were all completely blocked. After leaving their first engagement with the warriors bloody and broken, and in fact one of them had been, one of the SQ had actually been shot in the face and later died by a warrior, although it's not entirely known who shot first, the SQ showed that they had completely lost control of the situation. So in response, they brought in the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who are like the Canadian equivalent of the FBI. The Mounties fared no better at all against the Mohawk than the SQ did. And with the SQ and the Mounties both showing that they could fail to contain this indigenous rebellion, Canada actually mobilized fully its modern American-supplied and well-trained armed forces to the people at Gunasatage. However, the warriors at Gunasatage never flinched, they never retreated, and they never gave up on defending their sacred land. And this was against the full might of the Canadian military. The final days of this resistance began on the 25th of September. That night, a lone warrior walked around the perimeter with a long stick because they had set flares around the perimeter of where they were holding with like trip mechanisms on them so that if the warriors tried to escape, it would set these flares off. So this lone warrior walked around the edge, the perimeter of the area with a long stick, and he set off all the flares to send the army into a panic. They turned a high pressure hose on him, but the hose didn't even have enough pressure to disperse a crowd. The warriors then also taunted the soldiers and began to throw condoms full of water at them. In one quadrant of the occupation, there was also angry goading by many of the warriors towards the soldiers who were actually taunting them, telling them that they were cowards and that they should open fire and actually fight them. On the 26th of September, at a treatment center in the community where the warriors were making their last stand, they actually proceeded to ceremonially dismantle their guns and throw them into a fire. They burned and smoked tobacco, and then they simply walked out of the pines and back to the reserve, their heads held high. It wasn't a surrender. It was a disengagement. But they were still rushed. They stood against 2,500 Canadian soldiers. And like I said, it was a modern, American-equipped, highly trained armed force. And there was, as well as also the SQ and the Mounties there as well. But against these 2,500 Canadian soldiers, 1,000 SQ police and the Mounties, there was never anything more than 30 warriors, one spiritual leader, one traditional chief, 19 women, and 7 children. And drawing strength from their own ancient traditions and ceremonies, they completely sent white Canada and the colonial state into a completely terrified state. And when they disengaged as like an act of revenge against the Mohawk, the Canadian state rushed them and violently attacked them, including the families of the warriors, which included children. In fact, in a display of true inhumanity of these white soldiers, a 14-year-old Mohawk girl who was bravely protecting her 4-year-old sibling was actually bayoneted right in the chest by the Canadian soldiers. However, following this, they were all arrested, they were all put on trial, but even the colonial courts couldn't convict them. Out of the 30 warriors present at Oka by 1992, so 2 years after the conflict, only 27 of them had been acquitted of all charges, and the golf course and the condos were never built.
Uhuru, that's really powerful and inspiring to hear about. And it makes sense that, you know, they refer to it as the Oka Crisis, because it sounds like it was indeed quite a crisis for imperialism.
Uhuru. Yeah, thank you. That was an excellent recounting of that struggle. And I do remember reading about that and remember a photograph that I clipped from the newspaper that I had for years of a Mohawk man on top of a tank with his arms, you know, his fists raised into the air. It was very powerful.
True. So we want to just discuss in the last 9 or so minutes on this program how we as white people, who, as we've talked about, you know, are a colonial settler population here living at the expense of the indigenous people, at the expense of the enslavement and ongoing colonization of African people and other oppressed peoples throughout the world, how can we take a principled stance of solidarity with the liberation of African, indigenous, and other colonized peoples? And this is a question that Chairman Omalia Shetela, the Uhuru Movement, the African People's Socialist Party, has been dealing with, has been addressing, and, you know, struggling for over 30 years. The African People's Socialist Party formed an organization called the African People's Solidarity Committee in 1976 as a way for white people to take a principled stance working under the leadership of the African working class revolutionary movement. And the African People's Solidarity Committee is holding its national conference in January 6th through the 8th, 2013. Everyone listening to this show right now should make plans to be at this conference. APSC is the only principled white anti-imperialist organization because of this relationship to the African People's Socialist Party, which has always stood in unconditional solidarity with the national liberation of indigenous people in this country. That is, in fact, a fundamental component of the theory of African internationalism, which guides the Uhuru movement. And I did want to open up also for Comrade Inamiki. You have said that it was actually your experiences as an indigenous person involved in struggle in North America, it was your experiences with white people, with white leftists, that you came to similar conclusions about what is characterized as the white left as what you eventually found in the writings of Chairman Omalia Shetela. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure, of course. You know, of course, I was based in Canada for years, but I am very involved in the indigenous struggles in the U.S. as well. And so I noticed that in the U.S., there's, with these so-called leftist organizations, whether they're calling themselves Marxist-Leninists or Maoists or Trotskyists or anarchists or whatever, that when it comes to indigenous struggle, they either outright ignore us. You might occasionally hear about Leonard Peltier's up for parole again, or in the case of some organizations, they pay lip service in their programs. They might talk about, for example, that we support the right for sovereignty and self-determination and national development, but they never go, they never explain what supposed sovereignty means, because in theory, we already supposedly have sovereignty, right? But it's ill-defined. I doubt certainly these organizations do not recognize, as the Uhuru movement does, that the Americas is the land of indigenous peoples. Quite differently in Canada, though, because of events like OCA and the subsequent resistances at places like Chapatin, Epawash, Caledonia, etc., indigenous struggle is a lot more in the face of the white left in Canada. And so there has developed, they would call it a solidarity movement around, but there's two major problems with it, and they're related. Is one, like the Americans, these organizations will never say that the land, all of Canada, it's not a specific piece of land like the golf course at Oka. It's all of the land is Indian land. They'll never say that. And rather, they will focus in on specific land claims. For example, there is an ongoing struggle in for the Six Nations people at Caledonia, which is just outside Hamilton, which is southwest of Toronto. And there's a lot of solidarity that goes around that, but it's because there's this piece of land called the Haldimand Tract, and that was taken from the Six Nations by the British and later Canadian governments. And so they'll focus around that particular issue, the Haldimand Tract. They'll never make the connection that it's not just the Haldimand Tract that's been stolen, it's all of Canada, it's all of North America, and it's all of the Americas. But tied up with that is their so-called solidarity is incredibly opportunistic. And I directly experienced this in the city I lived in for 8 years in Canada, Kitchener-Waterloo, that there was a large activist organization there. I guess you'd call them anarchists, but they didn't really have a clear line. But they were involved in this solidarity movement, but it was all opportunism. It was all about their bourgeois and petty bourgeois white student type leadership who wanted to get their 15 minutes of fame in the Canadian media. And so they used the struggles of Indigenous peoples as a way to get their own name out there, to get their own 15 minutes of fame. And so it was through my direct experiences with people like this that I came to my own independent discovery, if you will, of the idea of the white left, which I then was very pleasantly surprised later on to find was a very well-developed concept within the analysis of African internationalism. And that's one of the things that really drew me to involvement in the Uhuru movement.
And I think that, you know, this goes back to, okay, we only have 2 minutes left, but just the whole question of parasitic capitalism, you know, that white people sit on the pedestal of the genocide and the theft of the land of the indigenous people and the enslavement of African people and colonialism around the world is the basis for the opportunism that exists. And it's just so clear that, as the chairman has said, the white left and the bourgeoisie agree, you know, mm-hmm. on the relationship that white people have to indigenous people and oppressed people around the world.
Uhuru. So we are coming to the close of our program today. I really want to appreciate everyone for participating, Comrade Inamike, Tupac Kashina. It was great to have you on the program today.
We'll have to do it again.
Yes, yes.
Uhuru, thanks
yes,
for having
indeed.
Me.
1 hour is definitely not enough, so we will definitely do this again. And I also want to thank Comrade Johan Bedingfield for joining us, Uhuru, as well as Chairwoman Penny Hess.